Hi, my name's Beth and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 2nd, 1989. My home group is the Midtown Group, now in Bethesda, Maryland. And we meet there every Sunday night at 7:30 at the Roundhouse Theater. It's a great meeting if you're ever in the area. I have a sponsor and I'm sponsored today, which is important to me because I had a sponsor for a long time and never used them. So it's important for me to say that. I also want to say, if you apologize to Billy, I was a few minutes late this morning, which my husband called me worried because I hadn't gotten here yet, and Billy had called my house because I hadn't gotten here yet, and that's kind of what I did when I was drinking, made people worry about me, and I don't want to do that sober. And so I read the directions and it said 2 hours, and I thought, I can get here before that. I don't need to give myself 2 hours, again, the exception to the rule. And so it took a little over 2 hours, and we were about 10 minutes late. So I was really glad to hear Jen, too. I met her last weekend at that conference, so it was really good to hear your story. I am really grateful to be here today. On the way down, a couple of my friends were coming also, and they called me at the Wawa on 29, and one of my friend's fathers fell down the stairs this morning, so they had to turn around and go back home. And I was thinking as we were driving here, you know, thank God for AA and amends, because if she had still been drinking, that call wouldn't have come. Nobody would have been calling her to come back and to be there for her dad. And so I'm thinking about her, but I'm really grateful that she's done the work in AA and she can be there for her family today. This week, Billy asked me a long time ago, and by the way, your name comes up as Hillbilly on caller ID every time he calls me. I'm like, okay, Hillbilly's calling me again. Okay. He asked me a real long time ago to come down here and speak, and I kind of put it in the back of my mind, that's the type of person I am. I don't worry about it till it's right about to happen, because I would just think about it every day if I did. But so I just kept putting it back in my mind. And this week, all this stuff, I have a new job coming up, just all these things that I'm afraid of. And I was thinking about this, and I'm on the phone with my friend telling her about all this. And I'm going to go back a little bit. My sponsor spoke last weekend, and her first year of sobriety, her sponsor told her to get a God. And being defiant, she decided that her God was going to be a beacon's truck. And so that's what she prayed to, was the beacon's truck. And so I'm on the phone with my friend, full of fear, no God in my life, just telling her how everything's not going to work out. And underneath the bridge passes this beacon truck. And I was like, okay, I get it. God is, and I'm not it. And so I was telling my sponsor about this. And she said, you know, Beth, it's just not about you anymore. And that's the deal. And it's perfect for my topic today, which is primary purpose. And that's the deal. It's not about me anymore. And for the longest time, that's what I thought. It was all about me. I'm just going to quickly read Tradition 5, because I think it centered me a little bit. But it just says, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. This is our gift from God, and its bestowal upon others like us is the one aim that today animates AAs all around the globe. There is another reason for this singleness of purpose. It is the great paradox of AA that we know we can seldom keep the precious gift of sobriety unless we give it away. For us, if we neglect those who are still sick, there is an unremitting danger to our own lives and sanity. And that is the truth for me. And I found that out the hard way. If you had told me that my purpose in life was going to be this when I was 15 years old, I would have been like, I'm not interested. That doesn't sound like a fun purpose to me. But I'm going to go crazy if I don't try to help other sick people. No, thank you. Growing up, I always felt like there was something missing. I was always comparing the way everyone else looked to how I felt. And the way I felt never matched up to the outsides of other people. I was strange from the beginning. I don't know if I was alcoholic from the beginning, but I definitely was emotionally insecure from my earliest memory. I used to dig ditches and run into them and try to break my leg to get attention from people. Just really crazy things. You said you stuck your daughter outside, Natalia. I used to do that to myself. I'd take hot showers and run outside and try to get pneumonia. I am, by the way, the healthiest person on earth. I never get sick and never had a broken bone. But I was just starving for something to make me feel okay on the inside. And my parents, I had great parents, very loving parents. My dad's an alcoholic, but they gave me everything I could ever want growing up. I can't say that it was because I was abused or neglected or anything, a very loving family, but I was just weird. And I needed this attention. And I tried everything I could. I tried losing weight, changing my hair color, whatever it was, just to make this inside part feel like everyone else looked. So at the beginning of my life, I felt purposeless. I definitely felt purposeless. My parents had, you know, I was a pretty good kid. I was weird, but I was pretty good. I tried really hard at school until sixth grade, when I got all A's and a B, and I decided school wasn't for me, and if I can't get all A's, I'm not doing it, and I didn't, and that's about where I stopped, and I started getting into trouble then. I'd been a pretty good kid. I got into eighth grade, and something happened for me. You know, I had been, like I said, seeking the stuff. I had, my parents had called this thing, I think it was called the Big Brother Program or something like that, where they assigned this person to you to kind of guide you through adolescence. And I called them a couple times, and that just wasn't it for me. And then I tried, my cousin lives in West Virginia, and that has nothing to do with anything, but she was a born-again Christian. And I thought, well, maybe this is it for me. When I was really young, my dad had decided that he didn't believe in God and we weren't going to go to church anymore, which was devastating to me as a child. And so she was a born-again Christian, so I thought, I'll become born again with her. And this has nothing to do with religion at all, because it just didn't work for me. It just didn't work. And I did that for a couple months, and I just kind of felt like a fraud doing it, but I tried. And then I had a friend who was a Mormon, and I thought, well, maybe I'll try becoming Mormon. So I became Mormon for a while. And thinking about it, something that they had, and something that we have here, they have this fellowship amongst them that I was lacking. And I was so lonely and so just lost, so lost. And so I tried these things, and this was a whole summer of this. You know, I went to see my cousin, and then I was friends with this other girl, and then I went to visit one of my best friends, and my best friend down in South Carolina was smoking, and I started smoking, and I was like, this feels a little better than either of those two things. And then I got introduced to alcohol, and that's where it took off for me, and that worked like nothing else. That fixed it. It made me feel like everyone else looked. I could talk to other people, which I had never been able to. I was totally and completely insecure. And I took a sip of alcohol, and that went away. I wish it had just been a sip. It was a lot more than a sip. But that was the beginning for me. And I did whatever I could get my hands on. In the beginning, it was things like Vibrin and Butane, because I could steal it from 7-Eleven. And then I progressed to Mad Dog because there were flat bottles and I could stick it down my pants and steal it from the CVS that was near my intermediate school. And I did as much as I could, and that seemed to fill the thing that I'd been looking for to fill in me. And I took off, you know. My parents were kind of in shock. I had been this weird child, but pretty good. And all of a sudden I start running away and start changing, my whole outsides change. And they had been warned from the school, you know, when I had gotten caught taking a box of Vibrin. I mean, it's just caffeine, but if you take enough of that, you act a little strange. And so they had gotten a warning, you know, this might be the beginning of it all. You need to start watching her. And so I started to do these things. I started running away, and my parents started calling the psychiatrist. And I think that's another thing with this whole primary purpose, that I couldn't stand going to psychiatrists. It was like a game for me to see if I could, how mad I could make them trying to get me to talk. And I knew they didn't have what I had. I didn't know what I had, but I knew they didn't understand what was wrong with me and why I was doing these things. I didn't know why I was doing these things. I just knew. I got this feeling in my gut that they were not, they had no idea why I was doing these things any more than I knew why I was doing these things. And it was fun for me. It was fun. That stuff worked. And sitting in a doctor's office did not work for me. And I just sat there and I would pick these shrinks apart. I mean, just pick them apart. I had, you know, from head to toe, I had their life mapped out and how just completely and totally judgmental. And here I am running away to not extravagant places, but Lorton, Virginia. And at the time, now Lorton is actually a girl I sponsor. Her uncle built up Lorton. But at the time, it was a jail and pretty much condemned homes. And I was 13 years old running away to these men's homes, these people, really convicts, who made their own PCP and grain alcohol. And we would hitchhike down there from Vienna and run away for weeks on end. And my parents really, really were beside themselves. They had no idea what to do with me and how to control me, because that was pretty out of control. And like I said, I thought it was fun. I am such a delusional person. I just pictured, like, oh God, what a wonderful life this could be. I could just be like a housewife and live in. And when I say these homes were condemned, I mean, there was no carpet. It was just like the rotted out hard, whatever the flooring they put down is. Rats everywhere, and a bathtub full of this grain alcohol these people had made, and coffee cans in the freezer, and that was it. Cigarette butts everywhere on the floor, no windows in the house, and I'm picturing being a housewife with kids. And I'm not right. I'm not a right person. And I did this for an entire, probably 6 months. You know, I would come home to get clothes, and then I would run away again. And I convinced my parents that it was their fault I was running away. I convinced myself that my dad really wanted a boy. I was the second girl, and he really wanted a boy. I really honestly think he didn't want children at all, but I had convinced myself that he wanted a boy and that he was upset that he had me. And that's why I was running away, because there was no love at home, which is so far from the truth. And so, you know, I went on like this for a summer. My parents started to get smart, and they started to call the police on me. My mom had joined this thing called Tough Love, which was really my hell. And, you know, up until this point, I'd gotten everything I wanted. You know, I would manipulate them. I would say, well, if you just buy me clothes, I'll stop running away. If you just buy me a moped, I'll stop running away. So I'd run away on this little moped that went 30 miles an hour and have to throw it in the bushes to hide it. And, you know, and I was just really sick, really sick. I can remember them coming and looking for me. There was this one baseball field, and I would hide in the woods and just laugh at them looking for me. And how sick I was, how I just did not have a care for anyone but myself. My purpose was me, and that was it. And I continued this for the entire summer. The cops finally found me in this condemned house in the attic hiding from them, and they took me away to Less Secure, which I was a little disappointed in, because Less Secure is not locked, which for somebody, like, that wasn't cool to me. I wanted to be in the detention center where the people are locked up and really bad. So I was planning my escape, and my court case came up, and they sent me to a psych ward instead. And for me, you know, I've been diagnosed with everything under the sun, except alcoholism. You know, they're telling me you're depressed, you have eating disorder, you have this, you have that. We'll throw you on this medication, and you have to go to one AA meeting a week. And that's what I did. And so I got out of there after a month, and I was sent to my high school, which was Northwest Center for Community and Mental Health. And I felt good in places like this. I love institutions, because there are some really, really sick people. And I felt just a little bit better and not quite as bad. And now I'm mentally ill, but these people are seriously mentally ill. And maybe I really am seriously mentally ill too, but I really thought they were a little bit worse than me. So I went to this place. I mean, these people thought they were married to people like Stevie Nicks and stuff like that. I was at least in some sort of reality. They were not in reality. And so I was in there for a year. And I was probably angrier that year than I have ever been in my entire life. And I believe it's what it says in the big book. You know, we become irritable, restless, and discontent. And I had nothing to fix it. I had no AA and I had no alcohol, because I was getting tested every other day. And so I started to go really crazy, and I'm a master manipulator. I've always looked pretty innocent. My parents have always really wanted to believe me, and I convinced them after a year here that I really needed just to be mainstream back into high school, and that's really where it took off for me. where my alcoholism really took off, and I started drinking as much as I could, as frequently as I could. I had never had a legal drink in my life, and I hope to God I never do. I started dating a football player. I changed my image again. I've always been a chameleon. I know who to go to get the stuff, and this guy could get the stuff for me. And they would get me, my drink was Milwaukee's Best. I would drink a case of Milwaukee's Best. It was cheap and it did the job. And I had thought, somewhere I had come up with in my mind that liquor made me do, I mean, I did messed up things when I drank beer, but for some reason when I drank liquor, I did even more messed up things. So I would just stick to the beer, and if liquor was all there was, I would do that, but I tried to stay away. Now, I had no control once I drank the first beer. Whatever was there was gone, but alcohol worked for me. It did the job, and when I started drinking, I couldn't stop drinking, no matter what I told myself. You know, if I went out saying I'm going to be the designated driver tonight, I would just end up drunk and driving. There was no, even if I didn't want to be doing that, I had no control over whether I was going to drink or not. If it was there, I was drinking. And my friends started to get sick of me. I did a lot of things that I'm grateful for today. At the time, I wasn't so grateful for. I'm grateful that I blacked out a lot, that I don't remember a lot of the stuff that I did. But I did a lot of things that compromised the way that I would want to be as a woman, definitely. And I woke up in a lot of places that I would never want to wake up. I have two children today. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. And the thought of my daughter doing the things I was doing and ending up in the places I was is horrifying to me. And I'm sure if she's got what I got, I'm sure the day will come where that will happen. And that's another reason that I want the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to stay strong, because I don't know who's going to need this, and I don't want this to be watered down so by the time she gets here, there's no message and no recovery. If she needs it, hopefully she won't. But if she needs it, I want it to be intact if she does. So, you know, I continued this for a couple years, in and out of institutions. Pretty much every 6 months, like clockwork, I was in someplace else with some other diagnosis of some other problem. And by the time I was 17 years old, you know, I had the same situations happen. I went to my prom in a limo and I left in an ambulance. I had a really high blood alcohol level. I have no idea what it was. I had no underwear. I don't know where they went. They found me in the bathroom with this prom dress with blood all over it. And I have no, I mean, I wasn't with it. It wasn't like that. I stepped out of it somehow, and no shoes, no nothing. And I'm in Arlington Hospital for the second time, and I had just been in there maybe a month before, and they asked me if I knew where I was, and I had no idea where I was, and they said, you're in Arlington Hospital, and you might want to consider coming back in for the treatment of alcoholism. And I thought, these people are crazy. And the next day, I was drunk again, you know, having alcohol poisoning the night before, and the next day, I'm drinking again. And I didn't know until I was sober about 5 years that day that I got out was actually Mother's Day. My mom had to come and get me that night. And I could have cared less. I could have cared less. I didn't even know. And the thought was definitely not of how I was hurting her or what I was doing to my family. It was simply that I needed something to make me feel okay and to make me be able to breathe, because I can't stand the way it feels in my own skin. And I can't stand the way my head will not shut up. And when I drink, it shuts up. And when I drink, I can feel okay amongst you. And so I continued. I continued for another year, in and out of another institution, in and out of the detention I got for school. And by this point, I knew there was something wrong with me. Obviously, people were not doing what I was doing, and my friends started to see there was something wrong with me. You know, I was either suicidal or homicidal when I drank. I was the same height, but about 30 pounds lighter than I am now. I was a little thing in high school, and me trying to threaten to kill somebody was pretty funny. It wouldn't have taken much just to knock me right over, but, you know, I went to either extreme, mostly suicidal. I am of the depressive type, And so, you know, I continued like this. I was in a couple of car accidents. I managed to manipulate my way out of it, telling my parents that somebody hit me in the McDonald's parking lot, never mind the tree hanging from the top of the car. But and the $3,000 worth of damage that needed to be fixed on the car. And they believed me. They wanted to believe me so badly. They didn't want anything to be wrong with me. And there was something really, really wrong with me. I was dying of alcoholism. And by the time I got here, you know, my last drunk, it wasn't the worst. I didn't even black out, which for me was rare because I could smell alcohol and black out. And for some reason this time I didn't. I can remember hearing a Tom Petty song, Free Falling, and riding in the back of a car and thinking, my life is over. I can't do this anymore. Nobody wanted to be around me anymore. The guy I dated, if you can call it dating, we dated him through the week, had little incidences over the weekend, and then we would get back together on Wednesday, and it would happen all over again the next weekend. So I don't know what you call that, but I just turned 18. I was supposed to go to New York for some school trip, and I was sitting in my parents' living room, and the weekend before I had thrown a huge party in my parents' house, and by this time my dad had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my mom had become a member of Al-Anon, and they came home and they found beer cans everywhere, and my mom was just devastated that I don't know how she could know I didn't care about them, but she caught on I didn't care, and she felt really, really invaded that I would bring this alcohol into their house. And honestly, I didn't even care. I just wanted people to like me and come over and drink. And so the next weekend I was sitting at home, and usually by Wednesday I started detoxing pretty bad. I'd have to get something to drink because I was shaking so bad by the middle of the week. And I'd started taking their stuff called Epicac, and I would have to work on the weekends and I couldn't take it. So I would drink Epicac. It makes you throw up. So these people would think I was really sick. And every time I worked, I'm vomiting. Like, what's wrong with her? I don't know. I just need to go drink. There's nothing wrong with me. I just need some alcohol. And so this weekend came, and I was sitting in my parents' living room getting ready to go to New York, and I just thought, you know, I can't go on like this. I can't have another 18 years like I've just had. I would rather be dead than live like this. I can't do it anymore. I had no friends left. They didn't want to drink with me anymore. They started having parties and not letting me know where the parties were, and I would find out the next day that everybody was out having fun and I was at home because nobody wanted me around anymore. It was no fun to be around me. I always caused problems. And I really felt like my life was over. I would have rather been dead. I was praying to God that He would just take my life, that it would just be over. And it didn't happen. I was given a new life. I was given the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I begged my parents. It was Christmas time. I begged my parents to let me go to rehab for the 10 millionth time. I ended up going to Arlington Hospital again. And my insurance had run out because I'd been in treatment so many times that there was no money left for me. I capped out. I used mine and everyone else's. You know, I went to Arlington Hospital, and I ended up giving my phone number to somebody there that happened to want to stay sober, and who ended up calling me and taking me to these meetings, and I'm so grateful. So the person is no longer sober. The person drank after about 3 years, but I'm so grateful that she took the time to pick up the phone and take me to a meeting. I know I would not be here today if it weren't for her, because I instantly, as soon as I got out of that place, you know, it would dry me up for a little bit, and I would get out, and as soon as I got out, I would feel good. Everybody was glad to see me, and I'd go right back to doing what I was doing before. And as soon as I got out of that place, I did. It was around New Year's. I went to a drinking party, and I had a physical reaction to alcohol that I had never noticed before, because I was always drinking before, so I didn't get it before. But I was really, really shaky around it, and I knew that if I was going to continue to be around it, I was going to get drunk. And she brought me to AA. I wish I could say that I came to AA and did this, and I have just gotten continually better. I've seen people do that. It works wonderfully. I am a really good example of what not to do your first 5 years of sobriety. I was 18 years old. I was, I think, 2 weeks, 3 weeks sober, and I met God. And He took me to meetings. He took me to, you know, His friends. And that's all I needed for about 3 years. And I didn't do much. I got a sponsor that I called every now and then, that, again, never used. Maybe in really hard times I would call her. But that was it. I didn't, There was no purpose of carrying this message to anyone. There was the purpose of Beth getting what she wanted and the circumstances of my life changing so I can feel okay. And honestly, when I got sober, if just the circumstances of my life had changed, that would have been enough for me. It would have been enough. That's all I wanted. I just wanted the pain of right now to go away. And it did go away. It went away for a little bit. And so I continued to do this. I was really sick. I had no respect at all for Alcoholics Anonymous. We used to do horrible, horrible things in the churches. I had no idea that people came and set up the meetings for me, or the service that went into the meeting, or how hard it is. So we've had experience in our home group this year, how hard it is to find a church that will allow you to meet in it. I had no idea. And we did whatever we wanted. I did whatever I wanted in these churches. I'd talk through the meetings. We had parking lot sobriety. I would sit out there and smoke and laugh at the people inside the meetings. And it wasn't until I had around 3 years sober, and I'm grateful for this today. And I believe this is what happens to people that have alcoholism. If you don't drink and if you don't do anything to treat it, you will go absolutely insane sober. And that's what happened to me. I had around 3 years. My God left. My sponsor, whatever, wasn't really a sponsor, but this person that was my sponsor fired me and started drinking again. And the job that I had went out of business. So everything I had put power into in my life was gone. It was just gone. And I went absolutely insane sober. And I found another person that I could go on a geographical cure with, because why do any work? Why fix the problem? Just run. And I put my backpack on and my shoes and I took off. And that's what I've done my whole life. When I can't deal with the pain, I'm out of here. I'm gone. I'm gone. And so I moved to Georgia and then I moved to Florida. And I can tell you the only thing that I did do right was I went to meetings every day, and I ended up getting a sponsor in Florida who started taking me through these steps, which I had never done before. I wasn't interested. I was not interested. The only thing I wanted was just to feel okay. Just feel okay. You can leave me alone after that. I would stay up all night long smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, playing spades, and sleep all day long, and then get ready 3 hours long, getting ready for the meeting, making sure I looked right for the meeting that I wasn't even going to sit in, and then do it again every night. And I had around 3 years sober. I was... You know, I didn't get it. I didn't get what I had. I didn't get what I was dying of until I was at this point. And I had moved down to Florida. I had none of my home group. My home group had gone, you know, they talk about AA being a self-cleaning oven. And we had gone through this period. My group had gone from about 200 people to about 14 people. And it was a big, big deal. My sponsor and her husband, who actually later became my sponsor, went through this nasty divorce. And everybody was taking sides, and it was just a really big deal, and I went absolutely crazy. And I put her husband and her on a pedestal as God too. And so when they started acting human, I went absolutely insane. And so I'm down in Florida. I drove past a bar, and for the first time in my entire sobriety, I knew someplace. It wasn't even a thought. I knew in my body that if I drank, this would go away. I knew it would fix it. It might be a problem tomorrow, but I knew it would take this away. And it was the first time, I think, that I ever knew what I had, what I was going to die of if I didn't do something to treat it. And the sponsor in Florida started carrying the message to me, and that's what it's all about. You know, giving a message to somebody who doesn't know that there may be a way out, that there may be a different way to live than what I come up with on my own. And she started taking me through the steps. And she was really, I wish I could find her today. I don't know her last name. I know her first name was Carrie. And she was my angel down there. She really, really saved my life. And the person I went down there with got a back injury and started taking pills and has been drinking ever since. And that was over 10 years ago, and cannot get sober. And I know if it were not for her, I'd be with him. I'd be with him doing the same thing, because I didn't have the power not to do that. I had nothing in my life to make me not do that. And she had me get on my knees and do a third step with her, and she had me start taking a fourth step. And I got, you know, my resentments down, and I knew I had to come home, which was here. And I had to face the things that I had been so resentful about with my home group and with this man that I was so resentful towards, too. I came back here and actually ended up asking him to sponsor me. And he was, He wasn't very nice, actually. he was actually wonderful. He was the first person that I saw besides her. I was so crazy when I was down there, though. And it's just what I read in there. You know, if my purpose is not to stay sober and help somebody else achieve this, I get to go crazy. And I had gone absolutely insane. I was not doing anything in AA except for not drinking and filling my instincts. And she had me start on this path, and I got back here, and I got Mike to be my sponsor, and he started working the steps with me. He had me do my first really true and honest fourth and fifth step. My whole life, I thought it was the world against me. I thought I was the victim to everybody else. And he had me, it became really apparent that it wasn't the world that was the problem. You know, there was something wrong with me, and he had me start taking these actions that I didn't believe would work. I didn't know would work. And I honestly believe, you know, that I don't believe and then do something. I have to take an action and then I believe. And that's been the experience of my sobriety. You know, I don't go necessarily on blind faith. You know, I do the work and then I see the results. And it took me a really long time to get to the place where I believed that there was a God, that God is, or that he even wanted anything to do with me. And so we started on this road, and my whole life, I think it's self-centeredness, honestly, is that when I'm self-centered, my world is so small. It is just so small. And he started me taking these actions, and my world started to open up. I started to sponsor people. One of the girls is actually here today, Kim, who is actually the only one that's stuck. She's been here over 10 years now. When I sponsored a few people before her, but helping other people was physically painful to me. It was painful. Anything that stopped the thought of me was like, oh, God. No, and that's horrible to say, but that's how it was. I mean, it was really like you're interfering with my time thinking about me, and I can't do that. I can't. That would make me crazier than helping you, but I got to a place that, I was so insane sober that it was the only thing that gave me any relief. And I started working with these girls, and Kim came into my life in a time that I really needed her. And we had started this women's weekend and had a wonderful person come and speak, and I started to see that maybe there's something else. Maybe there's something bigger than me just getting that guy that I want to date or the right clothes. Maybe there's something more to this. Maybe there's an illness that I need to be working on here. Maybe there are things wrong with me that I'm not addressing. Maybe it's not the world that's wrong. Maybe it's me. And maybe there's some things that I can do to actually help somebody else out, too, along the way. And I started sponsoring these people. And like I said, Kim has been a godsend to me and stuck with me through thick and thin. And I'm really grateful for these people. These girls are my mirror, and they're what show me when I can't see me, because my perception is always I'm right and you're wrong. And I can see it a lot easier in them, what's wrong with me, than I can see with me. And so I started on this journey with them, and most of them drank. Most of them are still drunk, and I haven't seen or heard from them in over 10 years, and that makes me sad. These are people that, I mean, I really, really, really loved. I really fell in love with helping people, and they really, it was the first time that, you know, the first time you see somebody that you're working with go and pick up that one-year chip, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it, and the joy that I felt for the first time, true joy for another person, and it wasn't about me anymore, and I'm so grateful for that shift there, that it became about somebody else for the first time. And, you know, we continued to do this stuff. We started going to traveling and going to all these different places. We went to Hawaii for a conference, to California, to the world. And we just started doing all this stuff. Our group started getting bigger. We started getting involved in GSA and WAA and all this, getting involved in AA and really getting excited about AA. Along with getting excited about AA and doing AA, your life gets good. At least it did for me. It got really good. I started getting, and my sponsor had me start going to school, which is something I never, ever even wanted. I wanted to be a housewife. I was mad about women's lib. I just wanted to be a housewife. That's it. I just wanted to drink beer and smoke cigarettes and be a housewife. Everyone could just leave me alone. And anyways, he wanted more for me than I wanted for myself, that's for sure. And one thing I can say about my sponsor is, defective as he was always helping somebody. There was always somebody in his living room, and he was always trying to pass this message along to somebody. And he spent numerous hours with me in his living room talking about other people. And I never knew. It would take me like 3 days to realize he was talking about me. He's telling me these stories about how messed up so-and-so is and this, and I'm driving home 3 days later going, wait a minute. I wasn't talking about them. That's me he's talking about. I'm not the quickest study. And so he was sneaky about trying to get me to see me, because he knew that if he just flat out told me what to do, there was no way in hell I was going to do it. I would do the exact opposite of what he told me to do. And he was smart enough to know that. But he loved working with alcoholics, and he loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we got busy doing this, and my life started getting really good. I was in this relationship that I'd been in for a couple years that was not necessarily healthy for me. And I made the decision that it was time for me to get out and to be on my own and depend upon God instead of a man. And I did that. And my sponsor had me going to school all this time, and we finally got in the direction of going to nursing school. So I got into nursing school, which is good for me. I failed to mention I dropped out of high school my senior year. I was 3 months away from graduation. This is the story of my life. I'm so close, and then I just give up. But I do believe I would have gotten drunk if I had stayed there, because everybody there were people that I drank with, and I think it was the best thing for me. I dropped out. I got my GED, which was a huge deal for me. And going back to school was a huge deal for me, because I'm like Jen, I was the dumbest. I couldn't do anything, and I had no confidence in myself. And he built me up. I started with a keyboarding class, and I built on that. And he had me just take little steps. And I got into nursing school, which was a huge deal for me. And I met this man who's my husband today, and we got engaged, and we moved in together. And all these wonderful things started happening. I got my first car. I had always had like 10-year-old cars. I got my first car. I graduated from nursing school. And little by little, the things that were making my life good, I put ahead of AA, which is what brought me to that place of being in the grace of God, really. And so these things started to get in the way of I put them ahead of everything else, and AA started to lose its priority. And more, getting married in the right dress, and what our kids' names were going to be, and what kind of nurse I was going to be, and how much money I was going to make, and all this stuff became more important than carrying a message to the person who's still dying from alcoholism. And it took me, I was a good 5 years that I was just in this rut with, my priorities just being totally, totally off. And I think I've seen it a lot. I see a lot of people drink over. Life gets good, and it's easy to forget what I have. I forgot my first step. I forgot what I had, and I forgot the treatment for it, too. And so I got really, really crazy again, sober. And I was talking to Mike one day, and I was telling him all this stuff. And I was like, I'm so off the beam. I don't know how to get back on the beam. And he said, you're not off the beam. You're just kind of laying on the beam. And I had been laying on the beam for so long. I forgot there was a beam. I was just part of this thing, and I'm just not doing it. And I started, again, going back to what works, which is working with people who smell like alcohol and people that are dying from this thing that don't know that there's a solution, there's a way out, there's something, there's an answer for us. And it's being younger, going through these psychiatric places and talking to all these doctors, it was the one thing that was missing there. I knew they didn't get me. I knew when I was sitting in Mike's living room, he had what I had. He knew what I had. He knew what I was talking about, and he knew what he was talking about. And it's not even a thought that comes. It's something in my gut that knows that I can trust this person, and I can believe in what they're telling me, and I will get results from it. And there's such a comforting feeling in that identification of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And I don't know what that is, but I still get it today. When I'm in a meeting and I hear somebody share like Jen, and I that identification, like, I got it too, and they got it too, and we have a solution here that works. And so, I went back to that. I started going to a detox meeting once a week with, it was actually every other week, with Adolescence, which is my favorite place. I love the smell of these places. I'm still sick. I think I would still check myself in if I could and just stay for a week or two. I have a girl that I'm working with who can't seem to stay sober. And she can't. She keeps drinking. And it's so funny to watch her. She's in a detox right now, and she's going to go to a rehab, a three-month-long rehab. It's not for beginners. I'm still trying to figure this out. It's not for beginners, but it's advanced rehab. And they're going to have horses and really fun stuff to do there. Although she's allergic to horses, so she's thinking about maybe going to Malibu where she can not be on horses and it'll be a little bit better experience. But it's just funny to me listening to her. And I know that's not the answer. I know it's not going to work because it might buy you some time. And it might keep you sober or dry for the 3 months that you're in there. But what happens when you get out of there? I hope that they introduce her to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that they introduce her to a solution, because this has been the only thing that has ever worked for me in my life. It's been the only thing that's ever, ever kept me sober, ever. And I've been to many, many places, and I was drunk within a month. It's the only thing that has worked for me. And so, you know, we continued on this path, my sponsor and I, and I was really, really resentful at him for a long time, and he would tell me, you're the most self-centered person I know. You're going to need to sponsor at least 5 people to even touch your self-centeredness. I think you're just mean. It's all just a mean person, and I'm always picking on me. But he really, more than anything, wanted more for me in my life than I wanted for myself. And more than anything, he didn't want me to go back to the way I had been before, and he didn't want me to go back to drinking. And he instilled in me working with other people. He died August 15th of last year of cancer, and it was the most awful death I've ever seen. But I think the most amazing thing, sorry if I can get through this, was, now he wasn't a person that liked working. He didn't work probably more than 30 days of his whole life. He was not a worker. He loved to go to the beach and not work. So he had no health insurance. He had nothing. He had no money. And he had a house full of people taking care of him. And people taking care of him day and night. People slept on the floor in his living room to help him. And he had, I don't know if anyone's seen somebody die of cancer, but it pretty much strips you of everything. He couldn't use the bathroom. He couldn't eat. He couldn't sleep. He was just in a state of restlessness. And, I think the most amazing thing was seeing the way people showed up, the way we show up for each other here. And people would have, we'd have meetings at the house for him even when he was in the bedroom. And he was pretty coherent until the last week. And he would come out and sit in his wheelchair and we would just have meetings and he would make jokes. And he finally, I think around the last week of his life, a priest came and read him his last rites. And after that, he was able to let go. And it was an amazing thing to see. And an amazing thing to see Alcoholics Anonymous come together like that. And to see how we stick together, how unity works here, how the fellowship has worked here. And that we don't have to go through anything alone. And death can be a frightening thing. And I know he knew we were there for him. The last thing he said to me was, "You're a beautiful woman." And he said, he said, "You're a beautiful woman." He said, "And I'm really tired, so you better go home." And that's his way of saying he can't deal with the emotion, so you need to leave. And so I left, and that was the last I saw him. And alive, I got to go visit him after he had died, too. And it was an amazing experience for me. And to be able to see him alive and do this and be able to see him die. And do this. And AA was always it for him. He always had a big book with him. And so he has taught me what to do here in AA. And I've been working since that time. Actually, before he died, I started talking with my sponsor today because I knew it was pretty obvious his last year of life what was going on and what was happening. And I started working with somebody because I do have the belief today that I can't do this alone. If I go without help, I know where I end up. I have enough experience to show, I mean, as you can hear, where I get on my own. And I started working with this woman who has probably the most dignity of anybody I've ever seen. And and really, really, really makes me want to be a better person in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she is so unbelievably active in AA and so busy that I have no excuse not to do anything here when I see what she is doing. And it's very easy for me to feel sorry for myself. I'm busy. I work every weekend pretty much. I have two small kids. I have a husband. I have a bunch of girls that I sponsor. It's really easy to give excuses why I can't do things. But I tell you, the busier I am in AA, the better my life is outside of AA. My life is AA, honestly. I mean, we have meetings pretty much every day of the week that has babysitting so I can get to with my kids. My husband travels a lot. I have an amazing home group that is supportive of that, so that we don't have to have kids in the meeting. We have them earlier so we can still get home in time, and they're not up to all hours of the night. And because it's the need of our group right now, we have a lot of people with small children, and I'm really grateful for that, so that we can still be there. We can still get the message and still carry the message to those people out there. And I think the most important thing for me is to remember, I have this girl that's been talking to me lately. She came up to me and she said, you know, I don't have a drinking story. I've been sober for 5 years and I've done all these drugs, but I never really drank. And that's a problem. That's a problem. If you're an Alcoholics Anonymous, that's a problem. Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who have alcoholism. And so we're helping her try to get into a program that will work for her. And it's harmful for her, but it's also harmful for AA. And it's so easy to get into places where anything goes. Oh, I have an eating disorder, but, you know, whatever. I have a drug problem, but whatever. You know, I can still come here and be a part of this. And it's real attractive. Our group is very attractive. There are about 300 young people having fun. It's very attractive. At the same time, I think a lot of people probably come there that may have other problems that may not need to be addressed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the singleness of purpose of that, of one alcoholic working with another alcoholic, keeping to our main priority here, which is alcoholism, I think is the most important thing. And I hope to God that we always remember that, because I don't want AA to get watered down. I don't want it to be so watered down that my kids or their grandkids or my father, if he ever decides to come back to AA, he's decided that he doesn't need AA anymore. And he pretty much stays in the house all day long so he doesn't drink, which is not a fun way to live. My sister, who's also in AA, any of you who may have children that may need this one day, I want AA to remain intact, to remain here for other people so that they can have a way out too. AA cannot be all things to all people, but we have a wonderful answer for alcoholism, and it works. It works. It saved my life, and I'm so grateful for you people here today and for my life and my sobriety. Thank you.